This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be back with you after a rather lengthy break that I was able to take from the show and my work, and did some traveling in Europe, which I'll talk about in a little while. My guest today is going to be my daughter, Dr. Stephanie Alessi LaRosa. And we're going to be talking about her program in sports neurology at Hartford Healthcare. And specifically, we want to get into the questions that always come up this time of year with football and soccer starting with respect to head injury. And there's so many questions that come up with respect to how can I protect my child, my grandchild, what should they be doing, should they even be playing these sports. So we're going to chat with her a lot about her practice, the way it's set up, and how they approach young athletes who have had head injury. So I'm looking forward to that, and she's going to join us after the first segment. As I said, I've been away and traveling in Europe and Scandinavia, and I love when I travel because I get to talk to a lot of people, especially people who live in different countries, obviously in a different continent, and we get into eventually the discussion of healthcare. And I learn so much about really their impressions of the healthcare systems in their countries. So, for example, met a couple from England, and both wife was a teacher, actively employed. They have universal healthcare in England. And we hear all about the long delays. So in their particular case, it's one where the husband and wife, since they are older, purchased private health insurance, which means you get right in, you pay premiums like we do, and they have health insurance. Their children were on national health insurance, which is the universal plan, and their son tore his ACL. So had to wait a period of months before he can get surgery. And that's the way it works in a lot of countries. In Scandinavia, I found people extremely happy with their system. And it's interesting because the country in Norway as well as Iceland really invest in prevention. So, for example, you are not allowed to ride a bicycle without a helmet. Whether you're an adult or a child, you have to wear a helmet. If you are riding a motorcycle, you have to wear a helmet. Why? Because they have universal health coverage. That means the government is picking up the tab when you have an extended illness due to a brain injury, you're in an ICU, and may need care the rest of your life. So they feel that they have a right to impose that. And I think they're correct. If the government's going to be picking up the tab, they should be able to tell you what are the best health things you can be doing. It's also interesting talking to people. You know, I've had several comments come through emails talking about what Dr. Jonathan Liss spoke about in his interview several months ago. And that was the difference between lifespan and health span. Now, we know that everybody, most industrialized countries, have a longer lifespan than we have in the United States. Specifically, England, we know they do in Scandinavia. The question is their health span? Are they enjoying life? Or are they able to stay healthy longer to enjoy life? And that's a feeling I got from the folks in Scandinavia. These are people who live very active existences. Cycling, bicycling is very common. A lot of agrarian economies, but you don't see when you're out and about a lot of people with obesity. You see people who really seem to take care of themselves and are able to enjoy life longer. So again, you know, there are things we need to be doing here. The other thing I found interesting is when you're on a tour bus, you have to have a seatbelt on. I mean, they actually walk back and check to make sure you have your seatbelt on. Again, mandatory. Not just in a car. It is also on public transportation. So again, they look at how to stay healthy. The other thing they do there is the access to weapons is limited. Now, Finland, well, I wasn't there, but they have the more guns than any country per capita. But in order to possess a weapon, you need to be certified. You need to take a test. You need to have a, they look at your mental health. Okay, so again, these people are living longer for obvious reasons, because their government really cares. Now, also in my absence, many things have changed here, and really none for the better with respect to health. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has really distinguished himself as being the master of disaster when it comes to health care in this country. I mean, I can't use strong enough words to really try to express myself as to how badly things are going wrong. So, for example, we now have made the change. President Trump has now decides to revive the presidential fitness test. By and large, not a bad idea. I mean, again, it's difficult because some children are more fit than others at a certain age. Not everybody is athletic, but if it's some way of getting children more active and away from computers, I'm in favor of it. Great idea. But once again, we miss the forest from the trees here. What are we doing to make children healthier? So, let's look at what the biggest problem is. What's the number one cause of death in children? Guns. Guns. Children are getting shot. So until we address the big problems, why are we fooling around with worrying about fitness tests? What's another problem? Childhood diseases. Right? And what do we have? Let's get rid of vaccination. Let's have more exemptions. Let's lower the vaccination rate. The fraction of children exempted from vaccine requirements has risen to 4.1%, up from 3.7% a year ago. That's a lot of children who are not getting vaccinated at all. Meanwhile, 92.5% of kindergarteners got their required measles, mumps, and rubella. We are dangerously low to getting below the herd immunity. And guess what? We're seeing measles again. So, again, we're missing what we need to be doing. And we keep attacking and going after making changes that are not positive changes. Well, everybody's in favor of getting rid of pesticides around children or having them eat better. But again, that's a small fraction of our problem. And until we look at the broader picture, we're not going anywhere. Then, right, we want to look at, again, how do we create an environment for children to flourish? So we decide now that the Environmental Protection Agency, which is a misnomer, right, because there's nothing they're doing to protect us, because now they have canceled the scientific rules that are the basis for climate regulations. One thing they know about in Scandinavia is the climate is changing. And you could tell that because those glaciers are melting and they're not coming back. So again, we turn our back on the broader problem here and decide we're going to go in the opposite direction. So the agency that we pay for, everybody listening to this, we pay for people to protect our environment, protect us against harmful chemicals, protect us against pesticides, protect our air and water so that it's safe. And they decide to cancel any of the rules that protect that. So I don't even know why we waste our time with these folks. I've got a lot more to say, and you're going to hear about that in upcoming shows as we drill down on this and really look at what we're doing, what we're not doing in this country, what we should be doing, and what all of us listening to this program could be doing. This Day in Medicine, August 9, 1867, is when Dr. Joseph Lister formally introduced the antiseptic principle in surgery. He did that in an address to the British Medical Association. Now, Dr. Lister, obviously, we all remember him because probably the greatest marketing name in the world is Listerine as an antiseptic mouthwash. But Dr. Lister did a lot for making surgery safe. As I read this, I started thinking, well, just suppose somebody came along after he did this. And surgery, people knew how to scrub for surgery, sanitize the skin, make it safe. Somebody comes along and says, you know what, I don't think that's too good. That is antiseptics irritate your skin. It's probably not good for you. Let's get rid of that. That's what we're dealing with today. We're dealing with today who deny scientific principles that have kept us healthy. So with that, we're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back to chat with my daughter, Dr. Stephanie Alessi LaRosa, who is Director of Sports Neurology at Hartford Healthcare. And we're going to be talking about what you should know about sports and brain injury as we're coming up on scholastic sports season. If you wish to reach out with any questions regarding head injury, while we have Dr. Alessi LaRosa on the air, you can reach me at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it gives me great pleasure to have as my guest today my daughter, Dr. Stephanie Alessi LaRosa. Dr. Alessi LaRosa is a sports neurologist. She is a board-certified neurologist and practices a specialty which is fairly unique in the field of medicine, looking at injuries to athletes and specifically neurologic injuries. Steph, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Let's talk a little bit. So football season is here. We're starting to see more injuries, things like that. But just to refresh our audience a little bit, talk a little bit about your educational background and you know, what's attracted you to what is a fairly unique field.
Sure. So my training started at Sacred Heart University, my undergraduate, and I went to St. George's University for medical school, which is in Grenada of the West Indies. Then I moved on to a neurology residency at the University of Connecticut in Hartford Hospital. And after that, I did a fellowship in sports neurology at the Kutcher Clinic for Sports Neurology in Brighton, Michigan. And then I came back to Connecticut and started the Hartford Healthcare Sports Neurology Program 6 years ago.
Yeah, so you recently had an anniversary for the program. It's been 6 years already.
Yes, just this past Tuesday, so we're very proud of that.
So talk about your office itself. You have a staff there. What kind of folks are you working with as part of your staff? Really, I shouldn't even say your staff. I mean, it's a team. Mm-hmm. What's your team looking like over there?
Yeah, so my team consists of myself, of course, as the medical director, and I have a physician assistant. His name is Corey. We have an office manager, Lisa, and then in our front office, we have Natasha, who's primarily on the phones working the schedule, and Luce and Hope are our medical assistants, and then our nurse is Barbara. So we have a fairly robust team, and we started a fellowship program and graduated our first fellow this past June. And so we're really contributing to the field of sports neurology by training the future sports neurologists at Hartford Healthcare. So we're proud of that as well.
It's interesting because you also have an extended team, right? So you have athletic trainers you work with, and specifically physical therapists who are specially trained to treat neurologic injuries. Can you talk a little bit about the role of physical therapy in terms of treatment? When everybody thinks of physical therapy, they think of, you know, orthopedic injuries, knee injuries, back injuries, and recovery. But when it comes to neurologic injury, how does a physical therapist fit into the system?
Yes, well, our program primarily works with a very talented physical therapist in at the Hartford Healthcare Rehab Network in Wethersfield. Her name is Misty. And, you know, physical therapists that we work with are really all across the state. We try to meet the patients where they are in terms of building their team and having that multidisciplinary approach that's convenient for the patients. But really, it's important to find physical therapists with the right training of the things that we need to rehab for different neurologic purposes, not just the orthopedic, like you said. And, you know, it takes time and building relationships to really seek out the right people, but it makes a huge difference. You really can't understate enough how, you know, all physical therapists have different training and different interests. So it's important to find the right person. Just because a patient tried physical therapy doesn't mean that they've reached their maximum rehab potential. And that's really key for what we do.
Steph, just can you talk a little bit about some of the typical conditions you see in the course? Right away, when people think neurology, they think concussion, which is a big part of it. But can you talk about what are the things you typically see?
Yes, definitely head injuries or even prolonged recoveries from head injuries, things where symptoms have just prolonged and persisted for months to years. We do treat those folks as well. But really anything neurologic in active people. So that's in headache is probably the number one thing in neurology. So headaches and migraines, dizziness, you know, passing out episodes, things like that where we might have to do a little more of a workup to figure out what's going on. Sometimes we come across peripheral nerve injuries that have happened from sports involving the arms or legs. But spinal cord injuries, you know, really anything neurologic, which is what makes the field very interesting because we're not limited to just brain conditions or just peripheral nerve conditions. It really is the gamut.
All right, Steph, this is great information. What I really want to do is drill down. We're going to take a short break and then we're going to come back and talk a little bit more about concussion and the treatments for concussion and talk about sports and specifically what parents and grandparents could do to keep their family safe when participating in high-velocity collision sports. With that, if you have any questions, you could reach us at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC, News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and my guest today is my daughter, Dr. Stephanie Alessi LaRosa, who is Director of Sports Neurology at Hartford Healthcare and with her office located in the medical office building on Seymour Street at Hartford Hospital. The phone number for her office is 860-524-4330. Steph, on the break, we had a question come in, and it's a question from Mary saying, why do you primarily treat athletes as opposed to other people who have had, say, a motor vehicle accident or slip and fall? Is there a difference in the type of concussion?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, the brain doesn't know what hit it, but really the field of sports neurology is centered on helping patients return back to their active lifestyles. And so, you know, to get people performing highly, either cognitively or physically or whatever it is, for their lifestyles, really the patient population we take. Certainly athletes, as we know, have a higher risk of having a repeat injury. And so they do require, you know, a little bit more of a specialty or subspecialty, to make those tough decisions when to make sure people are safe when they're playing their sport. So that's really the main reason why.
So let's talk a little bit about, let's back up and go to, what's the best definition at the current time for a concussion in your estimate?
The best definition is that it is a transient injury, and it, so it resolves on its own, and it is a complex pathophysiologic response to different biomechanical forces that are imparted to the brain, meaning that the brain itself doesn't need to be struck directly in the head. It really is about the forces that can be imparted to the brain, either from a whiplash type of injury or some other mechanisms that it may involve. And it's a functional disturbance rather than a gross structural injury. So, you know, in emergency rooms, when you know, the doctors there may get a CAT scan or some sort of image, it's not necessarily looking at for concussion. They're really looking to rule out a more structural injury like a fracture or a hemorrhage or a bleed in the brain. So that's really the best definition of concussion.
Well, what I like about the definition, and I think we need to emphasize, is the word transient, right? Because so many people think if they've had a concussion, their future is laid out for them, right? They're going to have problems the rest of their lives and things like that. So can you talk a little bit about that transient nature for concussion?
Sure. Certainly at the immediate acute setting when an injury happens, there is a metabolic, you know, change in the brain where it's an energy crisis sort of for the cells at the cellular level. And there are issues happening, but in terms of, you know, having it last, it really does typically resolve within a week or two. There is more research going into that lately, especially with looking at biomarkers and other chemicals in our body that we can measure as a way of seeing how long it takes to really recover from these things. But where the research is standing currently, we really still believe it to resolve within 2 weeks, the acute concussive injury. Now, symptoms can prolong, and you know, we know those cases as well, but that's a different type condition at that point.
Steph, one of the things, you know, you and I both like to do is see people acutely. So not wait 2 weeks to see if it gets better or not. Some doctors won't see people until they've had symptoms for a couple of weeks. But you and I like to see them as soon as possible. Can you talk a little bit about why and talk a little bit about that philosophy?
Absolutely. It's really important because I think, you know, there's just not a lot of training on head injury and amongst either primary care physicians and the emergency room and things like that. So it really does take a specialty approach for head injury where we may be able to identify other factors early on that we can control for in terms of, you know, when someone hits their head, they often don't just get a brain injury, but they can have a mechanical injury that's happened to their head and neck. And so those symptoms, if they're missed or unaddressed or just thought, okay, it'll resolve in a week or two, you know, go wait it out, then the risk there is that now we've got a mechanical musculoskeletal injury that's not being addressed. And so the problem there is that can make symptoms prolong and keep people out of their sports and activities for longer. So it is important to have early intervention in these cases to really just have eyes on everything and all of the aspects. Some people who aren't sleeping properly from the concussion, you know, if that goes on for too long where they're napping for hours in a day, it really can be problematic when we're trying to get their life back on a normal cycle for their brain health. So those are some of the reasons why we try to do that. But it really is important, and it's not just, you know, oh, you're concussed. You know, that should be reassuring somehow and people should just wait it out. That's really not the best approach anymore.
You know, I think people are always amazed when we tell them, when they come in acutely and we tell them that we want them to get back to activity, right? Because the old philosophy of, you know, they should be locked in a dark room, no TV, no phone, and things like that. And yet we go in the opposite direction. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. There is more research now that's come out, particularly out of Buffalo with Dr. Letty and his group looking at early reintegration of low intensity cardio, like a stationary bike or something like that, or a treadmill. And those things can be actually helpful to their recovery. So there's even a randomized control trial out of Wisconsin that happened looking at 2 days of rest versus 5 days of rest, and the 5 days of rest group did worse. They had a prolonged recovery. So it is really important to again, have early intervention and getting some exercise early on, you know, especially in athletes, because resting athletes, even if it's for their benefit or for their overall, you know, the safety risk, resting athletes does harm. It is a harmful decision to athletes. So we really want to minimize that as much as possible, so that we're not, you know, asking for other issues, right? Where then their social life is changed, and then their sleep cycle is off from the lack of activity, and then their mood is off, and then, you know, all the other things that kind of come with that and being out of sport are really important factors to consider.
Steph, can you talk a little bit about, and I know a recent book chapter that is pending publication that you wrote that I found interesting from the standpoint of the things we misinterpret or physicians may misinterpret as a concussion and use that label maybe a little bit too much, even when people say, oh, I have post-concussion syndrome. But there are other things it could be. Do you want to talk a little bit about that differential diagnosis for us?
Yes, this is something we deal with quite a bit in the office, because the bottom line is that not every hit to the head is a concussion. Not every hit or strike to the head causes a brain injury. So, you know, the way things have kind of swung lately is somebody gets something hitting their head and then they have a symptom that it must be a concussion. You can have symptoms for other reasons for striking your head. So I wrote a chapter that, like you said, pending publication, should come out in the Clinics of Sports Medicine Journal in around February. But it looks at the mimickers of concussion, and these are common things like post-traumatic headache. So you can hit your head and have a headache, not have it be a brain injury, but, you know, cause significant headaches, which is a, you know, quote-unquote concussion symptom. And just need to be treated for the post-traumatic headache, or post-traumatic migraine, or, you know, neck issues. Like I said, if you hit your head, your neck is anatomically right there and oftentimes mechanically involved. So these are all pieces of mimickers of concussions that, oftentimes just are, you know, again, like you said, misinterpreted, or just, you know, the concern is to just catch all the concussions, so we call everything concussion. But that's, again, not the best approach, because we could be getting people back to their sport sooner, safer, and really thinking about what's happened to that person is important.
Steph, I want to talk a little bit about treatment. I mean, previously wasn't much to do, okay? But now we start using some herbals and natural treatments. Do you want to talk a little bit about those treatments that you use commonly?
Yeah, there's definitely a few. You know, in my practice, my approach is to not really give prescription medications. This condition rarely requires that, although if someone's having migraines that are intractable or some other conditions, we may be a little more aggressive about those with prescriptions. But by and large, typical concussions really shouldn't require too much prescriptions. But there's definitely a world of supplements and research that's being done in those areas. I think the commonly used ones for us is really on the headache side, using vitamin B2 or riboflavin in high doses, as well as like a magnesium oxide. Those can be really helpful for reducing migraines and even turning down the sensitivities of lights and sounds that come from from head injuries and from with those migraine features. So we typically use things like that, but there's a lot of interest in something you know, like creatine, and many other supplements. Honestly, there's too long of a list to go into, but the research just isn't there to tell us if creatine is the right move or if everybody should be doing it. Most of the studies have been done in animals. We just don't have the numbers on that information. So there's some limitations still out there for what supplements we would recommend.
Well, I'm glad we made that clear. Well, what about when should somebody take a non-steroidal. So a lot of people, you get a headache, right? So you're reaching for ibuprofen or Aleve or something of that nature. At what point should patients be taking those medications or not taking them?
So there is a hypothetical and relative risk of blood thinning from those types of medications, anti-inflammatories. So we usually don't recommend those for the first 24 hours after a head injury, and to maybe use Tylenol or something without that property to it for the first 24 hours. After that period of time, then, you know, we do often recommend using naproxen or Aleve or something like that to try to break the headache cycle and just get people more comfortable and on that trajectory of recovery.
At what point do you order imaging?
Yeah, that's, you know, sort of a case-by-case decision. Not everybody needs a head image. Again, because, like I said in the definition, concussion doesn't show up on scans. But, you know, it can be useful if someone's having symptoms going on for an extended period of time and we just want to make sure there's nothing structurally happening. That would be a reason to do that. Otherwise, you know, it's really based on how people are improving, what's their symptom course, and what concerns we really have. Now, if somebody tells me in my office and it's like day five of the injury and they've only gotten worse every single day, is worse and worse and worse, that would be a scenario where we would have to get an urgent CAT scan from the office. And we often do that when we need to, because I'm worried about some other condition happening, maybe not concussion. So those are sort of the extremes, but that's how I use imaging to help.
Steph, you know, along those lines, what are the most common sports that you found in your practice that people participate in and end up with neurologic injury, whether it be concussion or other injury?
That's a good question. I think, you know, I really do see injuries happening across the board. I mean, even if they don't play sports, you know, sports are not the problem. It really is. You know, kids being kids, right? There's playground injuries, there's bike riding injuries. There's injuries wherever, whatever kids do. And that's okay. That's part of childhood, I think, too. But at the same time, in terms of like volume of injuries from sports, certainly we think of football, you know, the collision sports, football, ice hockey, lacrosse, men's lacrosse. Those are really the key collision sports. And, you know, as you and I both are ringside physicians, we do deal with combat sports athletes, so boxers and mixed martial arts athletes. Those have high volumes of injuries. But, you know, there's lower impact injuries happening, you know, across the board that may not be concussion. And that's where I think we're really helpful for explaining to patients what has happened and if they were having a brain injury or not. And I think that's important.
What's your philosophy regarding football? I mean, people are always struggling with this. And, you know, it used to be in the old days, right? No mother wanted their son to play football. But dads always won that argument for some reason. Since all the publicity about concussion and all the knowledge we've gained about concussion, it seems like mothers are winning that argument these days. And there are fewer athletes going out for high-velocity collision football. What age, if someone came to you and said, what age do you recommend if my child has a dying need to play tackle football? Where do you think it's safe?
Well, great question. I get this one a lot. You know, I do think that obviously the brain is still developing even into the early 20s. Okay. So it's not like it's just high school or something, but I do think that, having more skills and development up until, you know, high school begins, high school is a reasonable time to start, tackle football. If somebody again has that dying urge and need and, you know, they're begging their parents every year, then, I mean, I would say probably if they could hold off till age 14 or, you know, freshman year of high school, that would be better than starting at the younger ages, where really the head to body ratio when kids are smaller is not in their favor, you know, at all. So that's one thing. Plus, they also have very weak necks. And when the neck is weak, it is more susceptible to, again, those biomechanical forces that can be imparted to the brain. So there's a lot of development of the rest of the body that is also a factor. It's not all about helmets and pads and those types of things. They can only really do so much. So I think that's probably the best advice I give patients and their families. But I also tell them, you know, because I get this question when someone's concussed. So they're like, well, should he go back? Should he not go back? And I say, look, we're not going to make that decision while you're concussed. Let's get through the injury, and then we can have more reasonable conversations about what that would look like, you know, given that we're in the heat of a situation right now. But when you're feeling 100%, maybe we could be a little more clear-headed about it, and you can weigh everything out for yourself then.
You know, I think it's important there. And let's back up a little bit, because you and I are always faced with different devices. If I bought this particular mouth guard, this particular collar, this particular helmet, you know, would I be keeping my child safe? And without getting into these products, I think you brought up a good point, and that is, you know, developing neck muscles. What would you recommend? Would you recommend people see a trainer or a physical therapist? Because it's obvious biomechanics that if you can keep the head stable, you're in better condition to withstand an impact to the brain. What do you tell people to do?
Yeah, I mean, the data is sort of mixed, but, you know, really I do tell people there's no harm in strengthening your neck, and it can only be helpful. So so I often, either if they have a strength and conditioning coach that they use already, you know, we have them connect with them. If they don't, then we often refer to physical therapists to do some neck strengthening for that purpose. You know, I do find a lot of this is important with soccer players who are heading the ball. You know, especially at younger ages, you know, they just don't have the neck development, and they start kind of heading the ball awkwardly, and then it's giving them headaches, and it might be even headaches coming from their neck muscles, we call those cervicogenic headaches. So, so there's a lot of different factors that play, when the mechanics aren't, the optimal strength of the neck. So I think that's a great place to start.
Stefan, looking back, can you just walk us through? So someone who comes to see you after an athlete has had a concussion, say it's gone on a few days, and the athletic trainer tells the parent, you know, really you should go see Dr. Alessi LaRosa. What's a visit like, and what's kind of a – and I understand, listen, there are no – if you've seen one concussion, you've seen one concussion. But what would be a, kind of a typical evaluation and plan put together?
Yeah, great question. So, I mean, the evaluation is pretty standard. We try to follow a good clinical formula that takes an extensive history of what happened and what mechanics were sort of involved in the injury. And details about, well, did you fall from a standing height? You know, were you running at full speed when you collided? You know, things like that. We ask nuanced questions about, and then we take even a detailed history about their family history, because especially in children who may not have developed migraines themselves, but maybe they have a family history of migraine or a family history of anxiety, depression, or ADHD, or some of these other factors that we know can prolong recoveries from concussion. So we do ask about all of that as part of our history. And then we do a thorough neurologic examination, checking the whole nervous system. But in addition to that, we do examine the neck in all of our patients, and for the reasons like I mentioned before. And then also the eye movements are very important. There's a test called the vestibular oculomotor screening test, or the VOMS test, which is a concussion test. It was developed to be a concussion test, but it's also just a great clinical tool, especially as neurologists, to look at the eye movements in various ways, and seeing what symptoms may be related to a concussion or other pathology. So that's kind of the assessment aspect. And then, you know, we try to put all of it together and come up with the right plan. You know, a lot of people, again, have a brain injury component potentially, or maybe a mimicker that we talk about. Or we just kind of talk about the mechanical aspect of things that need to be addressed. So it may involve some anti-inflammatories, may involve physical therapy, may involve discussions about how's your hydration and adding some electrolytes when needed to bulk that up. How's your mood? Do you need a talk therapist? Do we need to start, you know, monitoring some of that? And some of the other various factors, like you said, there's just so many pieces, in each case is so different, and each head injury, even within the same patient, each concussion to concussion from them is all different. So it's important to have an individualized approach really when making the plan.
Yeah, and I think you brought up a good point about the mental health aspects, because for many athletes, their entire social circle is their team, especially young children. I mean, these are the people they spend weekends with, nights with. So, you know, getting them back to at least being around their team in some capacity makes a big difference at all levels. But I'm glad you mentioned about the mental health aspects. So here's something. When parents are on the sideline or at a game and see a child hit or their own child gets hit, how do they know? How should people know when that athlete needs to come out of the game or they've possibly been concussed?
That's a great question. So, you know, I'm always amazed at when hits that sound bad or they look really bad, but then everybody gets up and looks like they're doing okay when I'm on a sideline, and that's what I'm looking for. But if we see a kid that's like slower to get up or confused about where to line up again, or they just aren't playing like themselves, and maybe there was a standout hit or something that, you know, somebody did see something, it's important to try and alert, you know, either the coach or if there's an athletic trainer available. That's the best approach there. But those are some of the signs, you know, that you can pick up on, just kids just not playing right or looking right or just moving slower and things like that. Certainly if there's a period of loss of consciousness, that's a clear sign, you know, but they can be very nuanced, and I'm always surprised even at the ringside with boxing and, combat sports that, you know, how much the brain can actually take, you know, where when we do the post-fight examination immediately after and, you know, the guys look fine, you know, and it's actually amazing. But then there's other times where they get one lucky punch and they're laid out. So it really is just always this, you know, it's about being very observational and just really having eyes for it is really important, I find.
Which is where we will be tonight. You and I will be at ringside at Foxwoods Casino watching MMA athletes beat each other up, for sure. Steph, thanks for doing this. Thanks for coming on. You know, one of my greatest joys in life is being able to work with you at ringside and in the office and along with you and your sister. So I especially enjoy these chats we get to have in front of the public and talk about what we happily do. Thanks again, Steph.
Thank you so much. Take care. See you later.
Love you, kid. Take care.
Love you. Bye.
We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. It's been great being back with you live today. Next week, we're going to be chatting a lot about some of the governmental changes here by the fools who are now running the Department of Health and Human Services, specifically with vaccine decisions that are going to hurt every one of us at some point in our lives. With that, I want to thank my guest, Dr. Stephanie Alessi-LaRosa. I especially want to thank Kevin Corser, who's been on the board and holding down the fort in my absence. With that, next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford HealthCare, Rachford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.